morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am your host and tour guide, Hiata. As part of this service, each weekday morning on GCN, I expose the beguiling and destructive myths associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, and with military and economic schemes. If you'll listen, your eyes will be opened, and you may change your mind towards some of these human institutions. Instead of merely presenting the news, my mission is to help you understand what is occurring behind the headlines, all while predicting how these events will shape our world over the next 20 years. Then, during our second hour, we're going to engage Yahweh on his terms, by way of his one and only covenant and through his always dependable Torah, which means teaching, not law, so that with God's guidance, you will be able to replace your religion with reason and engage in a relationship with God. Our phone number, if you'd like to question, criticize, or affirm anything that is said during this program, is toll-free, 877-300-7645. First item in the news this morning is the fiscal cliff. Is it about entitlements? Is it about taxation? Is it about spending, deficits? How about politics? Or is it just about personal egos now? This is the way that Reuters encapsulated what they called the crisis. Talks to avoid the U.S. fiscal crisis stalled on Wednesday as President Barack Obama accused his opponents of holding a personal grudge against him, while the top Republican negotiator called the president irrational. Yes, it is now a crisis, and each of the sides is slandering the other. It has resorted to ad hominem attacks, simply a clash of egos. Now, as I've shared with you, and I've also had Craig Smith, who I think is the foremost authority on the condition of the U.S. economy, present on this program. America is far, far better off going off this so-called fiscal cliff. As a matter of fact, the entire term fiscal cliff and the alleged crisis is manufactured by the International Monetary Fund. It began to use the term and warn America about it going back almost 2 years ago. The reality is that if we go off of it, two things happen, both of which are necessary. The first of those, is that more Americans pay tax. The Bush tax cuts furthered a trend that has been disastrous for this country. It swept tens of millions of taxpayers off the tax rolls, so that now half of Americans pay no tax whatsoever. And when they pay no tax, they do not participate in the system. And therefore, they do not understand the relationship between taxation and the economy. They are net beneficiaries of the government. They are not contributors to it. And so to have more people have what Craig would call skin in the game, it's a business term, which means that unless you're invested in a project, then you are not committed to it. But to get more people to have skin in the game, to make America fair economically, we have to go off this cliff. More Americans need to be paying taxes. Now, raising taxes on the most productive Americans, bad idea. That part of it will generate less revenue. And it's simply punitive because Obama hates those who have been successful. But the rest of it is necessary. It's not that all tax is wrong. It's a system where the majority of people pay no tax and a small minority pay virtually all the tax. That kind of a system is wrong. What it does is it rewards failure and it punishes success. And what that leads to is a failed economy. And with a failed economy, you have a failed nation. The other part of the fiscal cliff is also necessary. We need to cut government spending, not a little bit, but by a lot. And while the fiscal cliff only cuts it a little, it's at least a move in the right direction. The The article continues, as a year-end deadline nears, Obama and House Representative Speaker John Boehner are locked in intense bargaining over a possible deal to avoid the so-called fiscal cliff of harsh tax hikes and automatic spending cuts, which could badly damage the already weak economy. They're presenting this in the media as if it is a real crisis to be avoided. Harsh tax hikes. What we're talking about here is that the Bush tax cuts were primarily focused on removing people from the tax rolls. And so rather than being a harsh tax hike, it simply gets more people to participate so that more people begin to think from the proper perspective about all of this government spending. If you're actually having to pay for the government indulgences, you might think a little bit more differently about them. And as for the spending cuts, most of them happen to be targeted towards the military, which we could eliminate if we just honored the Second Amendment. It would make America impossible to invade. You know, moreover, the U.S. military is prohibited by law from actually defending America. If they were deployed in America, defending American freedom, they're in violation of law. Obama said he was puzzled over what was holding up the talks and told Boehner's Republicans to stop worrying about scoring a point against the president or forcing him into concessions just for the heck of it. Can you imagine being so egotistical, so self-absorbed, that in a discussion about the cancer that has already destroyed America, its deficit and its economic pedophilia, where each generation robs and rapes their children on behalf of their own personal greed, that this man would say that the whole argument is nothing more than scoring a point against him and just for the heck of it? He would go on to say, and I quote, "It's very hard for them to say yes to me." Wow. We have a president that has gone off the deep end. He has always been egotistical, and yet he defines arrogance. As Scott yesterday was speaking of arrogance, actually read the dictionary definition of it. In this particular case, this man is the living embodiment of it, because he has absolutely no experience whatsoever economically. He has never worked in private industry, not a day in his life. Has never contributed to the U.S. economy, never once. He has never so much as served fries at a McDonald's restaurant. And yet he thinks this discussion is all about him. They just can't say yes to me. Boehner and Obama have each offered substantial concessions, this article says. Now I'm moving to a different article, same news source, and in a deal that is designed to reach a compromise. That's what they say. Neither one of them have offered anything, really. Obama has agreed to cuts in benefits for seniors, while Boehner has conceded to Obama's demand that taxes rise for the richest Americans. Now, many have said, and Craig Smith foremost among them, that if you were to give the President of the United States a silver bullet that would at once solve the U.S. economy, would at once put Americans back to work in the private sector, that would at once reduce the gargantuan $16 trillion deficit. But if that plan did not have a caveat that would enable him to strike a blow at those he despises, the most successful Americans, he would oppose it. That's the reality. As for the spending cuts, all this president has agreed to do is to consider cutting the rate of increase in Social Security, so that the rate of increase in Social Security payments might be slowed. That's not a cut. That's an increase. It's a promise to consider the possibility of tempering the rate of growth in the nation's second most expensive program, Social Security, the Ponzi scheme. The effort was designed, this article says, to avert the steep tax cuts and across the board spending that will take effect unless the deal is enacted into law before December 31st. Some Washington insiders saw a 50-50 chance of going off the cliff, which the Congressional Budget Office says would bring on a new recession. We haven't left the last recession. In rapid developments on Monday, the two sides came significantly closer to bridging the gaps on critical issues such as tax hikes for the wealthy and cuts in Social Security cost of living benefits. Only when you talk about Social Security cost of living benefits, this means a reduction of the rate of increase, not a cut in the program. Obama, whose definition has for months been taxpayers above $250,000, has traveled up to $400,000 in his latest offer. Bonner was at $1 million, but could move down to $500,000. Oh, boy, what a wonderful compromise. Oh, there is so much hope. And for this, Obama has offered a quote-unquote fast-track process for major tax, and this does not say minor, but that's why the modifier is not before spending reforms in the year ahead. It's like the Reagan years where Reagan says, all right, I'll modify some of the tax reductions that we put into effect that caused the economy to turn from a misery index to that which is by any standard robust and flourishing. On the promises that the Democratic Congress would cut spending. Their promises were worthless. They did nothing. The promises of this man to you increase taxation, and I will promise that someday in the future I'll consider spending reforms. It will never happen. It'll be smoke and mirrors. It's what happened in the Reagan years. And it is the example for us to use now so we don't repeat the same disaster. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yana. You can engage in this discussion by calling 877-300-7645. This is the way that it was phrased by the journalist, we'll use that in air quotes, writing for Reuters. A comprehensive cliff-avoiding agreement would immediately substitute new and more targeted spending cuts for the indiscriminate slashing of defense and non-defense programs known as sequestration. Think about that. This very journalist, in his own article, said that there was no agreement on targeted spending cuts. All there was a promise by a man who has a tendency to break his promises to consider slowing the rate of increase in one program. And yet this nincompoop writing for Reuters said that more targeted spending cuts would be immediately put in place against the indiscriminate slashing of defense and non-defense programs. The cuts in defense are minuscule. America spends more on defense and intelligence, which is tied to defense, than the rest of the world combined. And we use it to make bad situations worse. That's what we did in Iraq. That's what we did in Afghanistan. That's what we did in Libya. That's what we're doing in Syria. It is counterproductive. It is just astonishing, the ignorance and irrational nature of those who work in the media. This is the concluding comment. Possible plans, and I found this, by the way, way down to the end of the article. possible plans to produce cuts in spending for Medicare and Medicaid, the government health insurance programs for seniors and low-income Americans, respectively, remain to be discussed. In other words, the number one most costly program in the United States, if you look at, you know, the big three are Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and defense. Those three collectively represent over two-thirds, close to three-quarters of the U.S. Federal and state spending. We have to include state spending in here because the cost of Medicaid much of it is pushed off to the states. Those are the big three. And the number one, the most expensive program is Medicare and Medicaid. And it has not even been discussed. Tells you how just totally lost Obama and Boehner are in these discussions. Speaking of lost, a couple days ago, I shared an article with you, went through the entire story of how a German man was apprehended from a bus while on vacation in Macedonia, and how the Macedonian government, at the direction of the U.S. CIA, turned this man over, who just normal guy, just out on vacation, to the CIA, who for about a month sodomized, tortured this man in the capital of Macedonia. And then after doing that for a month, torturing him for a month, abusing him for a month, depriving of him of all of his rights without any due process for a month, they hauled him off to Afghanistan so that they could make the tortures more egregious and be away from any prying eyes. And several months later, they realized, we had the wrong guy, and just dumped him on the street, someplace like Albania. Well, evidently, not having received that memo, not bothering to know that the European court had voted, I think it was either 14 to nothing or 17 to nothing, to say that the man's story was absolutely credible and that the United States, what the United States had done here was reprehensible. Well, now you've got a bunch of senators saying, oh boy, you cannot associate the United States with torture. This is how the article reads. It says, a new film about the hunt for Osama bin Laden is inaccurate for suggesting that torture helped lead to his discovery. Well, if torture didn't help lead to his discovery, why did we torture so many people? Is the United States now trying to deny that we used torture, particularly in the light of the most recent European court findings? Well, that is according to three U.S. senators who outlined their objections to Zero Dark 30 in a letter to the head of Sony Pictures Entertainment. Catherine Bigelow's Oscar-tipped drama, their letter claims, is perpetrating the myth that torture is effective. If it's ineffective, why do we do it? If it's wrong, why do we do it? Gets us right back to the discussion we had yesterday about gun control. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Ayana. You can call us and participate in this discussion by dialing 877-300-7645. Catherine Bigelow, who is responsible for the movie Zero Dark 30, says that in her movie she is attempting to refute the myth that torture is effective. She said there's a variety of controversial practices and intelligence methods that are being explored through the movie. Now, the fact is that the United States has used torture, and we've used it repeatedly. We've used it on thousands of individuals. And we typically do it outside the United States because it's illegal in the United States, and yet it's United States government officials that are the ones orchestrating the torture. Matter of fact, the first national decision in this regard in the most recent war against this mythical enemy called terrorism. It's actually a war against Islam, but no one will admit it. Was a letter from George Bush's attorney general. And he outlined the administration's, at that time's, perspective on why it was appropriate to torture inmates at Abu Ghraib. And then the CIA sent operatives to Abu Ghraib and trained the low-ranking servicemen and women that were there and told them how to carry out the degrading tortures. And so when then they photographed them and the photographs were published, what happened? The men and women who were following orders were sent to prison. And those who orchestrated the torture hid behind them. It's what is happening here. It's the John McCains of the world that are responsible for the program. In fact, that bragged about the program and talked about all the useful intelligence that we got from torture and how torture was being used to keep Americans safe. And now when torture is depicted in this movie as a means to find bin Laden, they cry foul. Purely hypocritical. The trio, which this letter was co-signed by Mrs. I Hate Guns, Dianne Feinstein, Carl Levine, and former presidential candidate John McCain, they said that all who, by the way, are members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, that is an oxymoron, said that Sony and its CEO, Michael Linton, had an obligation to alter the movie. Now, do we have an obligation to alter everything that is said in Congress because most of what they say is contradictory and dishonest and opposed to the very document that these people were sworn to uphold?
At the time when they were doing all this, wasn't Obama Osama, wasn't Osama the most sought after, like the most wanted person by the United States?
Unfortunately, yes, he was, for reasons that are born out of myth, but yes.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying that it was right that he was.
So, but he was.
So now they're trying to say that they didn't use those tactics, that they didn't, I mean...
Well, we've clearly admitted that we've used the tactics, and we've been held guilty in international court for using the tactics. So I guess all they're saying now is we don't want the fact that we use these tactics put in a forum where people will actually come to see and associate them with us. You know, people recognize, hey, no one reads newspapers anymore. They're not going to learn from those articles we've been sharing on this program. But if they see it in the movie, they're going to associate this with us. We don't want to be associated with it, even though we did it.
I'm sure Germany would prefer if you didn't bring up Nazis, and I'm sure that, you know, if there are not...
Or the Holocaust.
Yeah, the Holocaust. Or if there's any Nazis, I'm sure they'd prefer if you didn't, you know, bring up Hitler's bad things that he did, you know.
Yeah.
You can't rewrite history or rewrite the facts in order to make them suitable for you.
Oh, you can if you work in the U.S. government. If you're a member of Congress or in the White House, that's how the game is played. You know, I was meeting with a very high a political strategist, a national political strategist, and he says our entire mythology is to make perception seem like reality. We are here to shape people's perceptions so that they see the perceptions that we are presenting as real.
On another note, isn't this, wouldn't they be hindering the creator of the movie's right to free speech?
Of course.
So,
of course. But the most amazing thing is the advocates of torture and the ones who spoke about why it was necessary, particularly John McCain on behalf of President Bush when he was running against Obama, and now is doesn't want the United States associated with it. It's pure hypocrisy.
Idiotic.
It's a BS. You know, there's another aspect of this whole thing, too. Osama bin Laden did not conceive the plan that we now know as 9/11. It's not his plan. That plan was conceived in the Philippines. Ramzi Youssef is the author of the plan known as 9/11. He is already in U.S. custody. He was convicted for the first bombing of the World Trade Center. In fact, as he was being flown away from it to prison, and he was told, hey, look, the towers still stand, he said, not for long. He conceived the plan. We know he conceived the plan. Anybody with a computer and access to a search engine can read his plan. It lists the targets. It lists the flight training that they would undergo in U.S. flight schools. It talks about the airplanes and how they should be flown into those targets and what the consequence would be. It's not Osama bin Laden's plan. The plan was not staffed by Osama bin Laden. It was staffed in Hamburg, Germany, at the Al-Qaeda Mosque. The mosque still exists, same firebrand preacher, preaching hate against all things non-Islamic. Still preaches there. The primary funding for the plan came from the ISI, the Pakistan Secret Service. Osama bin Laden was one of those who knew about the plan, but it was not his plan, and he didn't staff it. Most of the participants came from Saudi Arabia, because in Saudi Arabia, they are indoctrinated in the most fundamentalist form of Islam. And yet we're allies with Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. And I say the mosque still exists. The reality is that when we went in and murdered bin Laden, a bad guy, don't care that... Well, Osama bin Laden is no longer here, but we could have easily have captured him and brought him back for trial, but chose not to. When we came without due process and murdered bin Laden, what we learned is that he was irrelevant. That's why on so many shows now, when somebody associates something with Al-Qaeda, says, you're wasting your time. Al-Qaeda is irrelevant. They're a meaningless symptom of Islam. And the moment you begin to associate things with this organization as if this organization was the reason that they are doing what they're doing, that they're an enemy because they're associated with Al-Qaeda, you're missing the point entirely. What we learned from all of his computer notes and all of his letters was that he had no influence on anyone. He was not associated with any terrorist group in Iraq or in Syria or in Libya, or any place else. Every time, even the guys that would claim that they were Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula. The letters say exactly the opposite. That Osama bin Laden had no association with them, had no influence over them, and was bemoaning the fact that he had no influence over them. When we killed him, what we learned was that we went after a myth, a symptom, something that was wholly and completely irrelevant, and yet it made Americans feel great that their country could go off and kill this man. And there will be cheers in the theaters when the movie is played. But it was irrelevant. This entire war against Al-Qaeda has been a complete waste of money and lives. This article goes on to say, this is a quote from John McCain, the fundamental problem is that people who see Zero Dark 30 will believe the events that it portrays are facts. The three senators wrote, when in fact most of what they say is untrue. The film, therefore, has the potential to shape American public opinion in a disturbing and misleading way. How is it going to do that? John McCain, Dianne Feinstein, Carl Levine, if they show that the United States engaged in torture knowingly, purposefully, willfully, consistently, if they know that because they're going to witness it in a movie, how is that going to shape public opinion in a disturbing and misleading way? Do you think that if more people know the truth about what the United States did, that they will be less patriotic? And therefore, those equipped with the truth won't be as susceptible to your lies? Is that the problem, senators? The senator said the use of torture in the fight against terrorism did severe damage to America's values and standing that cannot be justified or expunged. So here are the very senators on the Intelligence Committee that were fully aware that the United States and actually participated in the approvals for the United States torturing people, not only in Guantanamo, but throughout Europe and throughout the Middle East. We're fully aware, we're briefed on the fact, even supported it at times, and now they're saying, oh boy, now the use of torture, bad thing. It did damage to America's values, of course it did, but you were the proponents of it.
I was going to say that maybe they're right. Maybe the government does do things that infringe upon our morals. And
that's exactly. I mean, it's just so astonishing that what they're afraid of is that since they know that people don't read newspapers, that by seeing it in the movies, they will recognize that the United States does engage in a moral activity, and it does so knowingly and willfully and aggressively. That when they recognize that, they'll be, what, less easy to control? They'll be less easy to deceive in the future? You know, they said they have a social and moral obligation to get their facts right. Aren't these the same senators that when the Innocence of Muslims film was produced, it got all of its facts rights? It was just amateurishly produced, but it got all of its facts rights that they called it reprehensible? So this is a film that has its facts right in that the United States aggressively tortures people. And it has to be condemned, and yet we want to condemn a movie that got all of its facts right on Islam, on the nature of Muhammad and his perverted behavior. We are pure hypocrites. And, of course, it was these same people that were saying that this film was going to be a propaganda tool to help President Obama's re-election campaign just a month ago. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. As a program note to tomorrow's program is going to be inverted. We're going to begin our discussion of the Torah in the first hour, and then we're going to turn to a discussion on Islam and its role in shaping the news in the second hour. We're going to do so because we're going to have IQ al-Rasuli back as our special guest tomorrow. We're going to hope to have him every Friday for the foreseeable future as we try to educate all who will listen into the true, about the true nature of Islam so that we understand how it's going to shape our future in a very vile and violent way. So, program will be inverted tomorrow in terms of the order of events. We're doing this because IQ lives in Europe, works in Europe. He does this as a labor of love, as his mission to mankind. And so we want to be able to accommodate his schedule. This is a story from out of the United Nations. Dateline is New York. Fighters from around the world have filtered into Syria to join a civil war that has split along sectarian lines, increasingly pitting the ruling Alawite community against the majority Sunni Muslims, UN Human Rights Investigations said on Thursday. Actually, this is a horrible paraphrase of what they said. The reality is it is no longer a civil war in that it's not part of a group of people within a nation fighting other people within that same nation. As I have shared over the last 2 years, the Syrian conflict is really a proxy war. It is a proxy war that between Saudi Arabia on one side and Iran on the other, because the United States tipped the balance of power in the Islamic world in favor of Iran, in favor of Shiites, when it invaded Iraq and gave Iraq to Iran. That stripped Syria from influence and control of Iraq to influence and control of Iran. It also gave Iran control of Lebanon. It also gave Iran control of Hamas. It also gave Iran enormous influence in Egypt. So collectively, to reposition its dictatorship as the most powerful in the Islamic world, the Saudis are seeking to fight a proxy war in Syria. But, of course, it gets worse. What you have is China and Russia in league with Iran because of the Caspian Sea oil reserves, which they have access to. And therefore, they are on one side, and the United States and Europe are on the other, because they're beholden to Saudi Arabia for access to oil. And so it is a giant proxy war. The deepened sectarian divisions, why don't they just say it? It's Sunni Shia. Don't need to say sectarian. This is all about Islam. It's their brother's hand is raised against their brother. The divisions in Syria may diminish prospects, have destroyed any prospects for a post-conflict reconciliation, even if President Bashar al-Assad is toppled. The reality is, and we've said this before, if Assad is toppled, it will be the same thing as toppling Mubarak, as toppling Saddam Hussein. The government that will be put in place will be more fundamentalist, more religious, more embracing of Sharia, and therefore worse. If Assad is toppled, and he is a bad guy, it's going to be worse for the world, not better. When Saddam Hussein, who was an enemy of Iran, was toppled by the United States invasion, a bad situation was made worse. That's exactly what's going to happen in Syria. That's not defending Assad. He is amongst the most reprehensible people in the world. But the people who are fighting him are worse still. The influx of foreign fighters raises the risk of the war spilling out into neighboring countries riven by the same sectarian fault lines that cut through Syria. Now, that's not necessarily the case. The divide between Sunni and Shia that exists in Iraq and Syria is significant. It is insignificant in other places. In other words, the Shia population in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia is very minor. It is only significant in a handful of countries. And so that isn't the issue. And if he doesn't understand that, then he needs to check the global population standards so that he might understand it. Now, this is an interesting story. We'll probably use it again tomorrow as I will complete the United Nations review of this conflict, because it is the harbinger of World War III. Very few stories are as important to you as this one. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a...